So who remembers in the introduction in the book you read the other night, who remembers what a book or a story can be compared to? Anyone remember?
No.
The road. Huh? No. Right at the beginning of the Sir Gawain introduction, the author talks about what a book or a story can be compared to. No one remembers. Okay. Well, it can be compared to a weapon. Remember reading that?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it can be compared to a weapon. So, have you ever thought about a book or a story in that way before? As it being a weapon? You ever thought stories were like bullets that had targets, and you can hit your targets with stories? Well, you could definitely smack somebody with a book. That would be one way. But I'm more or less, you can't smack someone with a story, at least physically, right? So stories are weapons that would be used by the leaders of your culture and society. People use stories all the time. But this doesn't mean that because stories convince, like a letter to your congressman might convince. It may not convince in that way. But why do you think stories can be used as weapons and that could shape the culture and society? Jude?
Because you, like, sympathize with the characters. Like, and, like, you see what they're going through. And you could, like, think about that, those things that happen in real life.
Yeah, that's true.
We read Uncle Tom's Cabin and stuff.
Right, and so the characters, the story, how did that hit its mark?
Well, it was like she basically made it to where it was fictional, but it was like historical fiction. So it was all things that happened a lot,
right?
And then everyone realized that they're like, oh, Uncle Tom, he's dead, mm-hmm. And then they felt sorry for him, and then. They're like, slavery's bad.
Sure, it convinced you of something using story. It didn't just say slavery was bad.
It made you like the characters and then see what they were.
Exactly. So the story drew you in.
Yeah.
There's a good story has an attraction, and it has a beauty or an ugliness depending on what it is, and stories convince and stories. Convict people and change minds through their attraction and their beauty. And that's not bad. It's impossible to avoid that. Every culture has its own set of stories. It has a narrative. And, you know, the same is true with your own stories. And many of you write stories and have written stories for this class. And we have to make sure that our stories are attracting people to the truth and not to a lie. You know, Nazi Germany had stories. Communist Russia had stories that convinced either someone of one thing or another. But the difference between some of those stories and other people's stories is that some stories are meant to attract to the truth. Some stories attract to a lie, which people think are the truth. Okay, so Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is kind of like that. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is one of those jewels of medieval literature. And it's unfortunate for us because we don't know who wrote it. And we don't know the reason why the author's name was never disclosed. What?
I thought it said
Tolkien translated it from the Old English it was written in. But Tolkien's not the author. He didn't write this. He just translated it. So we don't know who wrote Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And so in the Middle Ages, it doesn't seem like this was a very big deal to them about making sure that authors necessarily became famous and well-known. In fact, most of the time, the purpose of poetry was to make the hero or the characters in the story live on in the memory of the world. So they focused on the characters in the story more than they focused on the author. So in some cases, we do know who the authors were. So who wrote the Canterbury Tales? Maybe we don't know the author.
It's
He's widely known.
It's a weird name.
No.
Kipling?
No.
No, it's a weird name.
Geoffrey Chaucer.
Yeah, Chaucer.
Geoffrey Chaucer. Most people know who Geoffrey Chaucer is. That's okay. I give y'all a pass since y'all are young. But most everyone knows, at least adults, know who Geoffrey Chaucer is, and that he wrote the Canterbury Tales. But he's the exception to the rule. Medieval authors were much more likely to be unknown than known, and they're certainly more likely to be unknown than authors today. Everybody knows who wrote Harry Potter, anyone who reads, right? What's Harry Potter? Yeah, right. So, frankly, however, we don't know if the author of Sir Gawain is unnamed because of humility or because his name was accidentally lost. So, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was written sometime in the mid to late 14th century. What hundreds is that? 1300s, that's right. So around this time, there was a revival in a style of poetry known as alliterative poetry. So to put it simply, we normally think of poetry as lines of a verse that have a regular rhythmic metrical pattern and the words rhyme, like spot and shot. I'm sure we can think of lots of other words that rhyme. So we have that idea in our minds of what poetry is. And alliterative poetry is based, instead of on rhyming vowels, they use rhyming consonants. So think of it like this. This is an extreme use of the alliterative. The Sally sells seashells down by the seashore. I can barely even say it. So that's the extreme version of that. You notice how every syllable has an S. That's the idea, right? So tongue twisters are an extreme of the principle that's being used in alliterative poetry. And they're not really good examples to follow when trying your hand at writing this sort of thing. But they do sort of give you an idea of how it works. And the translation of Sir Gawain by Tolkien does a good job of bringing the alliteration into the modern English language. But in the 200 years before the time of this poem, the predominant kind of poetry was not alliterative, but metrical and rhyming. Think Chaucer. And really, Sir Gawain did not cause alliterative poetry to catch on as the more popular form. And even to this day, Chaucer is known as the father of English poetry. And we're going to read some Chaucer later on in the spring as time goes on. Significance. Why is this important? Why is this book important? Well, Chaucer and the poet who wrote Sir Gawain were contemporaries. What do I mean by that? What do you think that means when I say they're contemporaries? Jude? They lived in the same time, right. They were alive at the same time. They were contemporaries, but their poetry had different fates. Fortunately for Chaucer, his work never went away and has been read continuously from his day to ours. But the Gawain poet's work went into sort of a hibernation. And then it wasn't rediscovered. When was it written? In the 1300s. It wasn't rediscovered until 1839. So it spent a good 500 years in hibernation. Well, maybe less than that. Maybe probably about 400 years or so. So Chaucer and the Gawain poet were both English, but they used different styles of language. Chaucer's dialect is more in line with what we use today. Even if you picked up a version of Canterbury Tales that hasn't been modernized, you can generally follow the story. Some of the words might be spelled funny, and some of the phrasing might be kind of weird, and there may be some unfamiliar words in the text. But for the most part, you could read along with it. But Sir Gawain is much harder to read, because the dialect is far more foreign and strange to us than Chaucer's. And the difference is reasonable, because Chaucer was from the big city of London, while the Gawain poet was from the northwest Midland area of England. And you may be saying, well, those two areas aren't that far apart. I mean, if you look at England up there on the map, it's not that big of an area, right? Everybody knows where England is?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not that big of an island. How could there be such a difference in how people spoke in dialects? Well, we have to remember, there weren't cars back then for us to drive, for them to drive back and forth easily across the island. So there was no phones, there was no Facebook, there was no text messaging, none of those things. So there were no quick and easy methods of communication during the time of these poets. Therefore, people who lived what we would think of as relatively close together might still differ in their manners of speech in a profound way because they didn't often hear each other's variations of the English language. We have an advantage of if we wanted to drive 100 miles or go 100 miles from here, we could just hop in the car and a little bit over an hour, we'd be there. And we even have that today, like travel 200 miles north. You think people talk differently 200 miles north than here? Very much so. Even still with cars and instant communication and travel, there's still differences in dialect. It's not that big a difference, but we notice that it is very different.
You can definitely tell. You can definitely tell, like, people down here, they'll say something like coffee, but up there they say coffee.
Oh, well, yeah, well, that's a couple of thousand miles away in the Northeast. Yeah. So, or 200 miles north of here would probably be coffee, like that. Probably more of Lafayette instead of Lafayette. Yeah. We're actually the weirdos because everywhere around the country, there's a lot of Lafayettes around, like in many states. And we're the only ones that say Lafayette.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
People say
like Lafayette, Indiana. You would never hear anyone say Lafayette, Indiana. You'd probably get laughed at for saying something like that.
Did you know that other people celebrate Mardi Gras?
Shh. What?
Other people celebrate Mardi Gras.
Besides Cajuns?
It's not fair.
Why is that not fair?
Yeah, like
I went to Alabama or something and they had all their Mardi Gras decorations up and I was like, no.
They stole our holiday.
I know.
It's not that our holiday was that great to begin with.
And I was like, not from here.
Let's all get in big boats and throw
right.
Beads at each other.
Right. It's all, yeah, exactly. So anyway, I say all that to say that if we picked up like an unmodernized version of the Gawain poem, we would not understand much of what's written in it. It would just be very foreign and strange to our eyes and ears. So despite these differences between Chaucer and the poet, the skill of both of them is very impressive. In fact, many people think that the Gawain poet was more talented than Chaucer. Oh, how dare he. This makes the rediscovery of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight even more exciting. And it's very obvious when you start to read the poem that the author is very gifted in his imagination and in his writing and his poetic technique. So Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is contained in the same manuscript with three other works. And they are known as Pearl, Purity, and Patience. And as far as we know, these poems appear to be written by the same author. So Pearl appears to be an elegy. And what's an elegy? Anyone know what that is? Raise your hand if you know.
I remember from the intro.
What is an elegy?
I think it's like a mourning thing.
Mourning for what?
For someone.
For what? For who died. There you go. Yeah. It's basically a poem that laments someone who died. And in this case, most likely the lament was for the poet's daughter. So Impurity and Patience are both didactic poems teaching the virtues of their titles, Purity and Patience. So, and the Sir Gawain manuscript is at the British Museum. If you ever make your way out there, you could check it out.
Where is it?
At the British Museum in Britain.
I think I'm going to go all the way there just for that.
Not just for that. If you're in the area, if you're passing by, you can go see it.
Somehow.
All right, main characters. So the title of the poem gives us the name of the two most important characters. So we have Sir Gawain, he's the hero of the story, and has a long track record in the stories of King Arthur outside of this poem. So he is King Arthur's nephew, and he is a knight at the Round Table. And he has a very notable reputation. He's known as a faithful and a brave soldier. And under the name Gwalchmai, he appears in some of the Welsh mythologies, specifically the Mabinogion. In the Mabinogion, Gwalchmai is renowned not only for his ability to fight, but for his eloquence, how he carries himself. And he is said to accomplish more with his skilled speech than other knights can be with their weapons. So Sir Gawain is a poet. He's a talented poet. And he's a rhetorician as well. He knows rhetoric. He knows how to speak publicly and speak compellingly and persuasively to people. So Sir Gawain shows up at in Geoffrey of Monmouth's work under a few different names. Gualguinus with a W, and Walwanius. So that's Sir Gawain. So we have Sir Gawain. Who else do we have? Seems pretty obvious. Yeah, the Green Knight. That's right. The Green Knight. So the Green Knight is Bertilac. That's his name. The Lord of the Castle, which Sir Gawain stays during his journey to the Green Chapel. And the Green Knight challenges Sir Gawain to a game at Arthur's castle, and then to another game at his own castle. And Lady Bertilac is the wife of Lord Bertilac, and she tries to seduce Sir Gawain into adultery three times while he's staying there. All right, so let's move on to our summary and setting. So what's going on in this book? I'm going to give you the basic layout. So the setting and tone of the book are generally festive and full of vibrant colors. I don't know if you remember a few weeks back, I had said that it's very tempting for many people when they read medieval literature to cast everything in black and white or gray.
Like the Macbeth movie.
Like the Macbeth movie, exactly. That is a typical caricature of the medieval era. But this book, as you can see, with its, even the authors of the publisher of the Purple Book is trying to combat that stereotype by making it vibrant with vibrant colors. The newer Tolkien book is not quite so festive, but it does look cool though. Yeah. So the setting and the tone of the poem is pretty festive and pretty vibrant and celebratory. So the story starts on Christmas Day at a feast in Camelot. And King Arthur and his nobles and knights and ladies of the court are celebrating Christmas Day with great merriment and lightheartedness. And the poet tells us that they feasted upon the finest foods, they danced till their feet were hurting, and they sang Christmas carols, and they gave heaps of gifts to each other. And they played games with laughter and gratitude, and they filled the cathedral with praises to God for the incarnation. And it would be hard for us to imagine a people happier than they were. And the only way anyone can be as happy as they were is by putting Christ at the center of the celebration. And near the end of their multi-day Christmas festival, they gathered for a feast on New Year's Day. But before King Arthur can taste the meat and drink the wine, he, like a good Christian host, must wait until everyone else is served, and he must have a great story or adventure told, or even a physical challenge brought to the court. So finally, just as the first course has been served, a noise is heard, and the Green Knight appears. And Arthur is curious as to who this is, and the Green Knight comes up and proposes a contest, explaining that, like, look, I haven't come to fight you, I'm not an enemy, but I would like to engage in a little sport. So he challenges anyone to come and give him a blow with his axe. And whoever accepts the challenge will win the axe. But here's the catch. He has to also meet the Green Knight exactly 1 year later and receive the same hit from the Green Knight. So eventually, it is Sir Gawain who accepts the challenge and takes a swing and hits the Green Knight. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
That part was a little confusing. So if Gawain chops off his head, does the Green Knight have to chop off Gawain's head?
We'll get to that whenever we read about it. Just hold your thought. I know you've already read this. I know.
I can't remember that.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to all that. Okay. So let's move on to the worldview of this story. So think about this in your imagination. Today is a normal day. There's been a light drizzle outside, and every time you walk outside, water gets on your eyeglasses and blurs the scenery. Let's say your math class was in the next building, and you walked outside, and then you walked into math class. You wipe off your glasses because your glasses are all wet, and you pull out your notebook, and the teacher begins saying something, but you can tell that Pastor Matt is not speaking correctly. There's something wrong. He's no longer saying things about numbers like he normally does. He is telling you, as our introduction is telling us, that the fear of the Lord is the square root of 4. And he continues on and declares that Jesus' example can be learned from algebraic formulas. And finally, he explains that wisdom can be attained by practicing some weird form of addition that was just invented. Now, you're confused. You have no idea what he's talking about. You don't know what he's saying, and you don't know why he's saying it. And of course, you know that the Bible was given to teach us how to obey God and to put our trust in him and all that. And you know that Moses didn't come down from Sinai with math facts in his hands. No, you've read the Psalms, and you know that God says that each generation of believers must not forget to share with the next generation of believers the stories of God's faithfulness that was handed down and the adventures of his people. And you can't remember any biblical example of what Pastor Matt is saying, and you're pretty sure that your memory is serving you correctly. And later that evening, your dad confirms what you've been thinking and says that there is a reason why the Bible was not given to us in the form of numbers and math equations. So what's going on here? Well, obviously we can't learn to serve God rightly just by obeying and following a formula, right? We can't learn how to do that just by saying X plus Y equals this, and here you go, equals godliness, done. No, as creatures of God, what we tend to learn best from is stories. God gave us stories, and stories stay in our memories, and they show us what we should be doing in our own lives. They give us something to imitate and something to follow. And it's hard to imagine what the world would be like if there were no stories or no examples for us to follow. And if there even were such a world, it wouldn't be anything close to the wonderful creation that we are a part of today. You know, you and I wouldn't be the same people if we were people at all. So numbers are part of the story. And in one sense, people do tell stories with numbers. Euclid, for example, he tells stories with numbers. He's an exception. And of course, we see lots of numbers in the biblical book of
Numbers.
Yeah. But those numbers aren't the building blocks of narrative and of plots. No, narrative is what God created the world to be and how he brought it to be. So, plugging this back into Sir Gawain, we need to think about the importance of virtue. Can virtue be displayed in a mathematical formula? No, it cannot. No. And Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is clearly a Christian story. It's a Christian poem that exhibits virtues. And this doesn't mean that there are no errors or unbiblical teachings in the story. We'll find out what those errors are soon enough. But it does mean that a fellow Christian, who we will probably see in heaven someday, wrote this poem. And during the period in which Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was written, there was a whole group of stories and poetry called romances, which were designed to teach a knight how to fulfill his calling to the best of his ability, according to the code of chivalry. Now, the word romance meant something different for people in the 14th century than it does for us today. You know, if you look in the romance section of a bookstore, I don't encourage you to do that. It would be much, much different than what they viewed as romance. Now, what do we think of when we think of a romance novel today?
Death.
What? Did you say death?
No. I was going to say that probably because of all the propaganda there is, they're probably putting like LGBTQ stuff in.
Ah. Well, what do we normally think of? Love, right? Love stories. Sappy love stories. Yeah. And probably the romance novels, romance stories that were in the 14th century, they did have an aspect of love in it. But romance had to do a lot more with the adventure than motivated by love and honor than what we would call a romantic love story today. And the old romantic stories were of knights going out into adventures of risk and peril, dangerous places, and they defeat the bad guy and they claim victory for the kingdom from which they were sent. But the code of chivalry and the romantic notions of virtue were not always the same thing as Christian virtue. And the Gawain poet had this in mind when he wrote the poem. He wanted to show the difference between the cliche virtues of the chivalry codes and the Bible's teaching on virtue. Can anybody explain a little bit of what the code of chivalry is? Anybody know? Anybody heard of that before?
Heard of it.
Alan?
I don't.
You have to know everything about it, but what would be one aspect of it or an example of it? What?
Honorable.
Being honorable?
Courageous.
Honorable, courageous, yeah. And that's not unbiblical, right? What are some other things? If someone told you, like, you know, chivalry isn't dead, what would you probably have done?
Open the door.
Yeah, that's usually when you hear that, is whenever a man opens the door for a lady or waits for her to go in first. Oh, chivalry's not dead. You know, you usually hear that. I've heard that a couple of times before. So that's an example of the chivalry code. And some of these codes in the chivalry codes are biblical. Some are not. And that's what Gawain wants to, or the poet here wants to delineate with Gawain and the Green Knight. So so the goal of the poet was to provide an example for us that could be imitated. So Sir Gawain is really about the idea of what it means to be a Christian knight. And so when we deal with a particular worldview or a piece of literature, what we must always do is examine the source of virtue. Anything you read, anything you watch on TV, anything you see on the internet must always be examined with the idea of what is the underlying worldview, or what is the source of virtue? What does this worldview portray as good or bad? Right, and that's what we need to do when we examine this book. We must always examine the source of virtue. And this is important because, as James points out when he talks about the sins of the tongue, fresh water and bitter water cannot both flow from the same spring. So when someone suggests that you could question and you should question authority, you what should you do? You should automatically identify the source of that command and question whether they have the authority to say that. Where do they get their authority from? You know, two questions. Why? Is, you use these questions on the playground. Why? And says who? That's what you need to do whenever you have someone that says that you should question authority. Well, why should I question authority? And says who? You or someone else? And because if the source isn't God, if it's not God that says so, the source should be questioned and disobeyed. You ignore that. If God didn't say that you should question authority, then you should obviously ignore this person. So it's important to note that God establishes authorities that must be obeyed, such as parents and governments and church governments, because their source of authority is God. So the Greeks are an example of this point in literature. The Greek gods, somebody give me a brief synopsis of the Greek gods and their character. What is a characteristic of Greek gods, Grace? What's one characteristic?
Loyal.
Huh?
Loyal?
Unfaithful.
Unfaithful.
Disloyal. Unfaithful. Yeah, that's one. What's another one, Benjamin?
Very short-tempered.
Short-tempered. Yeah, definitely. Prone to anger. Unrighteous anger. Jude?
They're just like humans.
Yeah, they're very much like humans. So what are we? So that brings up the next question. What are some of our negative characteristics affected by the fall? Nicholas? What?
Greedy.
Greedy, yes. And that comes from being selfish. The Greek gods, like ourselves, are petty. We are vindictive. That means we want revenge when someone does us wrong. And like Jude said, they really weren't gods. They were just bigger versions of sinful men. What's that? That can shoot lightning, that have a lot of power. And because they were the source of power and virtue, they had authority, men like Achilles and the other notable Greek warriors, why did they fight? They fought for purely selfish and prideful reasons. And so that tells us what? That the source was bitter, and so the water was bitter. And Christian heroes can't be like pagan heroes. And so we must have a different source of virtue. We must get our water from a different spring. And the source of virtue in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is the God of Scripture, the triune God of Scripture. So where do we see this in the poem? Well, one of the key places where we discover the source of virtue is in the scene where Sir Gawain puts on his armor as he leaves Camelot to go and find the Green Knight. And most importantly, he is given a shield with a symbol on it called the Endless Knot, or the Pentangle, which is basically a star. Who's good at drawing a star? Benjamin, can you come up and just draw a star? So how do you normally draw a star? Do you do one of these and cross it like that? Or?
Yeah, I know, I just erase their lines.
Huh? You would just erase a line. Okay, go ahead and make it big.
That's big.
That's a big star. And now you erase the lines.
Big fat star.
No pressure. No one's watching you.
Everybody, we have to stare out now. Star Trek symbol.
Very good. Yes, there's our star. Voila. So why do we call it a pentangle? What does pent stand for?
Five.
So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 points. Yeah. So we see this symbol all throughout the poem. Why is it there? Well, each point symbolizes 5 more points. So the 5 senses, it symbolizes 5 fingers. It symbolizes the 5 wounds of Christ. So what are our five wounds? We don't normally think of four wounds. What makes it five wounds? So you have a wound here, wound here, wound here, wound here. Where's the other wound? In the side, right. Right, when the Roman soldier speared Jesus' side. Another thing this represents is the five joys of Mary for her son and the five virtues. The Gawain poet tells us that King Solomon shaped this star, basically a pentangle within a circle. The Star of David, you've seen that, right? It's a pentangle. So King Solomon used this star. So up to this point, the star was viewed as a Christian symbol. It's a Christian symbol. And so we also have to remember that all Christians were required to we're required to put on the shield of faith, which is supposed to protect us from the fiery arrows of the wicked. So shields have these stars on them. And shields in and of themselves are biblical things. They're godly things. They're Christian symbols. And Sir Gawain's shield points to the fact that the knight gets his strength and protection from God, not from anything else. And it's in the context of Sir Gawain going to battle that we see the shield emphasized by the poet more than any other weapon or piece of armor. Now, as we find out later, the main battle that Sir Gawain will engage in is one more of virtue than of physical combat. And we have to remember that the triune God is the source of Sir Gawain's strength in maintaining his purity. And it's Sir Gawain's shield that points to this fact. But we also find one of the unbiblical notions in the poem on the same subject of shields. As the poet tells us that there is a picture of Mary on the inside of Sir Gawain's shield. Now, how many of us know that there's nothing wrong with a picture of Mary in and of itself, right? There's nothing wrong with looking at the picture of Mary. But in the way that Sir Gawain uses this picture of Mary, there's a problem. And after he has been on his journey for some time, he prays to Mary that she might give him a place to stay. And this tells us that this was written in the 14th century, and the Protestant Reformation hasn't happened yet. And so the poet really doesn't see anything wrong with this. He finds this pretty normal. As a good thing. And he finds that Sir Gawain doing this is a virtue, but really it's a Roman Catholic virtue, and it's not a biblical virtue. And Jesus taught us how to pray in the New Testament, and one thing he didn't say was to pray to Mary. So another point in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is the rejection of adulterous love and unfaithfulness to your spouse. So this ends up being one of Sir Gawain's greatest challenges. This is one of his greatest battles. So he spends 3 days at Bertilac's castle being tempted by his wife. And every morning, Bertilac goes out and goes hunting, but Sir Gawain sleeps in. And it's when he's sleeping in and not doing anything, that's when Lady Bertilac comes in and tries to seduce him. This sounds like another very familiar biblical story. Who else stayed in from activity and from battle and was tempted? David. Yes, David. And who was the, she didn't mean to be a temptress at first. I guess, I don't know, maybe she was. But who was the lady he committed adultery with? Yes, Bathsheba. That's right. And so David and Sir Gawain were neglecting being productive. They were neglecting taking dominion. And whenever you neglect these things and you decide to live a life of leisure, expect to be tempted sexually. Expect it. It's going to happen. All right? So Sir Gawain is dealing with this temptation, and she uses methods in seducing him that are very revealing and important to notice. So in many ways, she is like the seductress in Proverbs 7. So she goes out of her way to catch Sir Gawain. She uses flattery. She also tells him, hey, no one's going to find out about this. No one's going to catch us. My husband's out hunting. He's far away. You know, nobody's going to catch us in the act. She deceitfully invokes her Christianity. All of these things add up to make Lady Bertilac a classic example of what Solomon calls the strange woman in Proverbs. She does not offer virtue to the faithful knight of Camelot, and he ultimately rejects all of her attempts to seduce him. Good for him. So, Sir Gawain in the end remains holy and innocent of sin. during this period, yes, sir.
Can I use the bathroom?
We're about to wrap up class, okay? And I'm gonna have to kind of curb my notes here because we're running out of time. Let's see. Here's some other aspects. So a Christian man, a Christian knight, is faithful to his God and does his very best to resist temptation and is virtuous. Sir Gawain also tells us and gives us the principle that a Christian man is a churchman. What do I mean by that? What's a churchman? Well, not only goes to church, but loves the church. Not just Sunday worship, but loves the church, loves the people of God. Because he loves the church, he's with God's people, worshiping the God of the Bible. He loves all of this. His life is totally immersed in the church, in the people therein. So we can see that the church was important to Sir Gawain because it was always on his mind, even when he was all alone in the woods. And out of all the things he could ask for, and admittedly, he did ask for a place to stay, he prayed for food, all these sorts of things. He also prayed, most importantly, that he could go to church on Christmas for the next year. So how many men plan their lives, plan their vacations, plan their trips and their family events around a faithful and exuberant church? I hate to say it, but not many. Not many these days. And how many of us even know that when, do we even know when Ascension Sunday is or when Pentecost is every year? Do we know? Do we keep track of these things? No. And it's sad to say, I mean, it's not necessarily your fault. You were just never brought up that way. Right? It just goes to show you how far off our culture is from our lives centering on the church. So worship on the Lord's Day in Sir Gawain's days was the center of his world and should be the center of ours as well. And another thing, a Christian man is also brave and courageous. And another way to put this would be that cowardice, being a wimp, is a sin. Being a wimp is a sin. How many of you have ever heard that, you know, they never said it like this, but Jesus being meek and mild, when some people explain the fact that Jesus was meek and mild, that kind of makes him sound like a wimp, doesn't it? You ever thought of Jesus as someone who just was like a man's man? Be honest, like someone who's like burly, brave, courageous. Maybe some of us do. But generally in the culture, most people think of Jesus as meek and mild, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. All these things are true. But at the same time, no one understands that Jesus was, he was as courageous as they come. Right? And he was not a coward. Cowards don't grow in sanctification because they're scared of being uncomfortable. Here, Sir Gawain is a model of courage. First of all, he's the only knight to step forward and offer to take the place of the King Arthur in the challenge with the Green Knight. Secondly, he keeps his vow with the Green Knight and travels for a long time by himself, fighting all kinds of wild creatures until he accomplishes his mission to meet the Green Knight. And Sir Gawain is also courageous in the fact that he does not succumb to the temptations of Bertilac's wife. So looking through the lens of courtly love, Sir Gawain was rude and impolite to Bertilac's wife. Now, the lens of courtly love, there were some other chivalry rules that were in play then. You know, if the lady that you're with requests something, you go out of your way to do it for her. You serve her in every way that you can. That's a really brief summary of the rules of courtly love. And Gawain was breaking these rules. So according to many in the culture, he was being rude and impolite to her because he was not doing what she wants. But this was, he was less concerned about his reputation with the lady than he was with God. And so because he feared God, he didn't fear the lady or the husband. So the fear of the Lord is an antidote to all other fears. And successful knights can't have those. So there's also the question of humor and beauty here. For the poet, there is no relativism when it comes to beauty. You ever heard that example, this saying that beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Mm-hmm. That's absolute garbage. That's not true at all. No. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the poet has a solid idea of what's beautiful and what's not. The Bible says what's beautiful and what's not. Rachel was beautiful. Leah was ugly. It says that in the Bible. Now, is that the writer's opinion? No. It's God's word. I think God can determine it. God doesn't have opinions. What he says is, it goes. That's it. So what that teaches us is that there is an objective standard when it comes to beauty. And we can see that in the poem here. One obvious example is the contrast that the poet gives between Lady Bertilac and her maidens, Guinevere, and the older ladies of the court. So Lady Bertilac is superior in beauty. And specifically, the poet gives us a very stark contrast between Bertilac's wife and the older lady of the court. He says, Lady Bertilac is very beautiful and attractive, while the older lady is quite ugly. Literally says that. So the fact that she was willing to commit adultery didn't change the fact that she was objectively and externally beautiful. And, of course, the loss of that would come later. All right, and so as we read this book, I'm going to have to wrap up here. We're running out of time. We have to remember that I believe God likes to laugh, and I believe he's commanded us to laugh. He expects laughter of us. He expects us to be joyful in our lives. He expects us to worship beautiful, like to worship him and give him thanks for the beautiful things that he's given to us. Okay, so when you think about God and imitating Christ, try to imitate his holiness in laughter. I don't think you guys have any problem with that. You're always laughing and clowning around about things. All right, so this is one of my favorite books that we read this year because there's such joy in it, and there's so many wonderful Christian virtues that the poem gives to us. All right, well, y'all have a great afternoon.